Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dave Deptula, Dean of the Mitchell Institute, and welcome to today's Aerospace Nation. Today, the Mitchell Institute is pleased to host Air Marshal Johnny Stringer, Deputy Commander of NATO's Allied Air Command. The Allied Air Command is a single service command that oversees all of NATO's air and space concerns. This team provides command and control of NATO's integrated air and missile defense mission. It's also responsible for NATO's air policing missions, ballistic missile defense, plus airborne early warning and alliance ground surveillance functions. Now, the timing of this conversation is really great since we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of NATO's establishment in 1949. So, Air Marshal Stringer, thanks so much for being with us today and taking the time to explain a bit about your command. So what I'd like to do to kick us off is to do just that, give you a couple minutes to describe your command and what are some of your top issues.
Great. Well, Dave, thanks very much for your invite. As you said, highly topical with the 75th anniversary of the founding of NATO and indeed the Washington Summit here in D.C. in 2 or 3 months' time. I think on one level it's a truism that, the events on and after 24th February 2022 have really sort of reset everybody's assessment of security both in Europe but I also think more globally. We'll come on to that in a bit, I'm sure. And those assumptions that we had for many years are no longer the sort of comfortable ones that they were. I'd argue that there were probably two long shadows that have fallen over air power, but not just air power, perhaps sort of Western way in defence. One, about 30 years long or so, which is called We Won the Cold War. And the second one, about 20 years or so, which is the focus on counterinsurgency campaigns at range from our home nations. So what they've done, I think, is forced us to do not just a lot of analytical work and in areas we're still in the foothills, but I think it's also forcing us to realise that we have to reinvest not just in equipment terms, so that is really important, but we also need to reinvest conceptually. And so for us, under my boss, General Jim Scorch Hecker, both boss of Aircom and Commu Safi, we've got five key priority areas. First one you touched on, integrated air and missile defence. It's kind of the birthright of all air forces to do that. And what we are seeing, not just in Ukraine, but what we've seen most recently with the Iranian attacks on Israel, the Levant more generally, and in the Red Sea, shows just the importance of that mission. And of course, that's IAMD also including defending against ballistic missiles as well. Second is how you defeat the threat posed by long-range surface-to-air missiles, by coastal defense cruise missiles, by other long-range systems, because it's likely to be air power that is a thing that is going to generate freedom of maneuver and freedom of access for joint forces. Third is being match fit on command and control. We now have to think about things in terms of survivability and resilience, not just the sexy end of technology in ways we've not had to think about for a long time. The fourth is information sharing that allows us to ensure across the alliance of now 32 nations in NATO that we can share the information that we need to. Times pass, we would probably find reasons for why some stuff was seen to be too sensitive. Well, we're in a different place now, so we have to find our way through that. And then the fifth, again, coming back to survivability and resilience, but now for our people and our platforms, is what agile combat employment looks like viewed across 32 nations. So not a short list, but it's a fascinating one to be getting after.
Well, that's a great rundown to kick off. Why don't we dig down into a couple more of the specifics that you alluded to, and one of which you mentioned right off the top, and that was dealing with the end of the Cold War. And I think you would agree that NATO took some risks in shrinking their air forces in the years after the Cold War. So we find ourselves today with air forces that aren't just smaller, but they're also populated with some really old aircraft. Meanwhile, the world's become a much more dangerous place. And we need more air power. The combatant commands out there are asking for more stuff. So could you walk us through how you see some of the individual nations of NATO working to address these challenges? And what does this mean, sort of, if you will, a strategy resource mismatch? What does that mean for NATO as a whole?
No, great question. So I think, and I'm going to be really careful here, because if you just chase equipment without addressing all the other lines of development, sure, stand by to fail. But it is a metric, so let's use it. If you look at the number of nations who are operating or are buying F-35, that takes over 700 fifth-gen platforms in the European theater in 10 years' time. Out of interest, only 50 or so of them will be US. Back to my point on information sharing, so we get the absolute most out of the aircraft that we've got. Equally, you've got a load of capable fourth-gen platforms out there as well. So the notion that you can just sort of bet the farm on fifth-gen is a, you know, if it ever was a notion, is a bit of a fallacy. So integrating fifth and fourth gen, maximizing what both bring to a fight, really, really important as well. You've also got to link it, of course, to munitions. So I think when you look at some of the programs that folk are buying into now, that is good in the sense of precise long-range strike. But you're absolutely right in terms of munitions and stockpiles. I mean, it's a matter of public record that many nations know that we need to be sorting out a defence industrial base that allowed to become quite small-sized and quite specific in some areas. Equally, I think it's been quite salutary that some folk who may have thought you can just throw a switch and get it back overnight, we're just not in that place. So we have to be consistent, we have to make long-term decisions here, and we have to give industry the assurance that we'll make it invest and make sure that we have the weapons and the numbers that we need. But then if I link my point on sort of conceptual as well as just kit. So one of the things we've done in NATO in the last year is have the first ever NATO Weapons and Tactics Conference, which it was kind of scoffed at before because, NATO doesn't do that. Well, NATO now does. So we looked at two problem sets. I won't go into massive detail on them. But what was unique about week two was we were able to give a level of security clearance above NATO secret that allowed us to really get into to the problem in front of us. And we are continuing to harness the output from that WEPTAC plus a whole bunch of other lessons, etc., not just from Ukraine but elsewhere. Small things but really important things. Rammstein would not have been in the business, and I have to be careful using the phrase, so with a small c and a small d, capability development, how do we use the convening power of an organization that brings those 32 nations and 32 air forces or so together? And one of the things we've set up is an A3 weapons team. Small, but allows us to get after problems with folk who really have genuine experience in a bunch of those mission sets. And then it's good to actually go out and exercise this at a level of sophistication and challenge, which again, I don't think NATO's air forces, at least in Europe, really have had the chance to do, and certainly not under a NATO banner for over three decades. So in October this year, we'll be holding our first Rammstein flag exercise, hosted out of Greece, flying over the Mediterranean with around 100 or so aircraft involved. And that promises to be a really important event for us. Finally, you can have lots of flashy initiatives, but you need to bring it together to a guiding purpose. So those priorities and those activities I've just set out there are all within an integrated by design plan. And we already, when you're looking at the sort of the markers, the how are we doing against desired progress. Yes, there's a lot of red because we're not there yet. It's a bit of amber, but there's a satisfying amount of green as well. So we really are getting after this in a thoughtful and structured way. And our individual nations are key in that discussion, as well as it being a NATO Air Command thing to cohere.
Well, that's great to hear. Now, one of the things that you and I were chatting about as we were walking in here is sort of Putin's strategic objectives of fracturing NATO backfiring on him. Specifically, Finland and Sweden have now joined NATO, and those are obvious milestones. What does their integration into NATO look like through an air power lens?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. NATO was at 30 nations when Putin, you know, brutally went into Ukraine, and he's now achieved the fact of generating two more. Finns and Swedes are massively capable air forces, by dint of geography and history and focus. They bring imagination in employment, in operations, as well as being operational. And obviously, how they, and that's everything from how they structure their forces on the ground to how they fly and fight. So that's almost like a sort of adrenaline shot of having two new nations come in and really bring their ideas and thinking in. Equally, NATO has had a discussion and engagement with both nations over a number of years. So integrating them to be effective tonight is a long way down the track. And we're putting a significant amount of effort into the accession and the integration of both of those nations' air forces into NATO, because we know how much they bring. Interesting to note as well, just look at the map now, what it looked like before February 22, and now what it looks like with the accession of Finland and Sweden, and Putin's brought himself a lot of geostrategic headaches.
Well, it's to our advantage, and obviously a good thing. And it is important to think about some of these moves in the context of not just down at the tactical level, but strategically the difference they make. Now, the modern battle space is really defined about empowering kill chains. And in the United States nowadays, we generally talk about this in the context of combined joint all domain command and control. How are you looking at this in NATO?
Yeah, so yes to C2, and not surprisingly, and a bunch of other things as well. So if I take, I'll take a mission set as an example, but I'll kind of then expand from it. So if you look at integrated air and missile defense, if you break it down into kind of subsets and therefore areas where you would want to invest, increase capacity, first off, you'd probably be looking at sensors of all forms. Secondly, the C2, to your point, to make sure that you bring together what you're knowing so you can make the most timely and effective decisions. Then look at how you posture your forces, and then look at what those forces actually consist of so you're making the right intelligent targeted investment decisions as well. If I now broaden it out to the sort of a much greater array of missions, if I look through it through both the CT and a number of other lenses, what I would highlight and work which we are absolutely focused on against those five priorities, first off, is how do you integrate fires and effects in the most intelligent way possible? And again, this is more than just sort of being joint. And I know many terms are available, but if I use the term multi-domain ops here, that's a very real focus for us, and it won't be lost on, I'm sure, anybody who's watching or listening, that air has always been at its best, and therefore defence has always generated optimum outcomes when we're integrating across domains, particularly what, you know, our time, speed, distance crunching attributes of air power give you. On the CT that nests that together, it's obviously therefore not just an air thing. So how do you make sure that we're putting the right people into joint formations? In NATO, that would be the joint force commands for three of them, but also ensuring that, that the support we're providing to Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, SHAPE, and the Supreme Allied Commander, General Cavoli, is right as well. Then how do you make sure you go and test it? And so one of the things we are really keen to do, and this is already underway, is don't just use your exercises as validating what you did yesterday. Use them as vehicles to experiment, see what you could do, see where things go wrong, and maybe most importantly, see where, if for a small investment, conceptually or in kit, you can now cross a divide and, back to kill chains, accelerate, do things differently, then that's just the sort of thing we should be getting out of stuff. That's what vibrant organizations do.
Very good. Now, one of the things that we've seen in Ukraine, it's pretty obvious, is the failure of either Russia or Ukraine to achieve air superiority. I'd argue, and I think you'd agree with me, that NATO can never afford to let that happen, because we see the result, and that's a repeat of World War I attrition warfare. So what lessons are you and your command taking away from this experience, and how are you thinking about those in the context of future plans?
Yeah, so again, I'd argue this is probably one of the things that we're focused on at the moment, back to the birthrights of air forces, what air power does across the joint force. So what I've said, you know, with the boss's direction is, let's take it back to first principles. There are things we do now that we've got very comfortable with doing. You know, we rolled them out during Gulf War I, many of them were the product of second offset strategy technologies. We've finessed them over 30 years or so. Meanwhile, the threat has evolved at a pace and a scale that I think even 5 years ago people would have struggled to really comprehend. Whether that is thousands of armoured FPV drones at the left-hand end of the spectrum, through to air-launched ballistic missiles and hypersonics at the far right, and a lot of the traditional stuff we were dealing with. So we really need to sort of look at that threat landscape, which we are doing, and going, right, how do you now posture yourselves, configure, what do you buy, the sort of the IMD, those four elements I spoke to a couple of minutes ago, how do we employ those? And to your fundamental question, yes, because if we're not providing air superiority for the joint force, you are seeing play out over the last 2 years what that means in Ukraine. I don't think anybody would wish that attritional artillery fest on, you know, their sons and daughters who might be called up to go and fight or are in the military at the moment. And this is what air and space power employed really effectively is going to do for the coalition. And I come back to, it's not just air doing this for air's sake. If you don't have this, you don't have access and freedom of manoeuvre across the joint force. But what I would add at the end of this, and you only need to look at the open source assessment of what the overall surface-to-air missile picture, I'll just use that phrase, in Ukraine looks like, to see just how dense it is. So our sense of going in and very quickly winning overwhelming air superiority in the matter of days, if not hours, I think we're going to see in peer-on-peer fight, God forbid we ever get there, the fact we're going to be eating away at this, and it's going to create pulses where we can go and do joint or multi-domain activity across the force. Over time, we will then get to the point with something we're probably more conceptually, intellectually familiar with now. But we're going to be eating away at it, I think, in ways that look a bit different.
A little bit of a segue to a related topic. We're seeing adversaries challenge airspace norms in ways that we really haven't seen since the Cold War. Could you talk to us a bit about how this trend's evolving and what it means for the NATO air policing mission?
Yeah. So effectively, air policing as a mission set has been done for decades. It is protecting NATO nations' airspaces across the entire European theatre, a system that comprises sensors, radars, etc., through command and control to fighters and surface-to-air missile systems or surface-based air missile defence. What we're seeing in terms of numbers is an increase. What we're seeing in terms of behaviour tends to be still professional, but with some examples where it is not. What I think is really important about air policing as well, and how air policing then sort of moves into the more operational space, but also the strategic space, is what we're also showing is we don't cede our airspace, we don't give advantage to others, that we are credible, capable and professional, of course, and we will go and intercept whatever flies into NATO airspace and check it out. So the sense of the mission, unchanged, the professionalism that goes with it, unchanged as well. But linking, I think, to how we're seeing that changed operational environment, one of the things for me is to make sure that people don't see air policing and air defence as things which are a long way apart. Because again, if we had to do this for real, we would need to move from an air policing posture to a more active air defence one very, very quickly.
Now, in that context, how effective is air policing in the context of credible deterrence?
Well, I think hugely. I mean, I would say that as an airman, but we're down again to capability, credibility, and the means to communicate it to a potential adversary as well. And I think if you don't show that you're actually willing and capable to go out and intercept close in or at range, then that leaves your opponent perhaps with the sense that, actually they're not match fit in this area and it's something that I could exploit. So it's non-discretionary, and it is one of the key pillars, I think, of NATO's nation's deterrent messaging.
And one of the things that you mentioned earlier, you talked about, were munitions. And I think it's no secret that NATO also took a risk cutting back their munitions stockpiles. You mentioned industrial production capacity because it's really dropped too. And I think one of the big lessons, if you will, we'll see if we've learned it or not, is that Ukraine has highlighted the need for much more munitions depth. So how is Allied Air Command responding to this reality?
Yeah, so first off, of course, I would love to have a massive budget. What we can do and do is set out to nations these are the lessons that we've picked up over the last 2+ years, plus looking more broadly. This is what we think we need in terms of actually going out and prosecuting a fight and prevailing. You can then, to your point, Dave, absolutely set it against an industrial base that we know we need in areas to reinvigorate. And back to what I said about giving now certainty to industry so it has the confidence to invest. I'll take a subtly different track on it as well, if I may, because, and it's back to sort of how we think about things. At some level, yes, you need mass. You absolutely do. But let's make sure we're using the mass we've got in the most effective way. So if there's something very clever I can do in mission planning that buys me effectively back 3 weapons that I no longer need to send because 2 versus 5 is likely to do it for me, I am de facto increasing the mass that I've got. So being imaginative right from the outset, not just hoping for more stuff to come in, it's kind of both lines that we need to be pushing for. And I come back to my capability development point. These are the sort of discussions and very active discussions that we're having with NATO's air forces at the moment.
Yeah, I just applaud you for that answer because I think that's exactly spot on. You got to balance capability with capacity. At the same time, you can't use capability as an excuse for not buying enough capacity, because at some point numbers matter.
Yep.
Fifth gen, you talked about that a little bit already. I'm going to give you another opportunity, particularly with respect to the F-35 and just what the impact of NATO or on NATO is of the growing number of nations that are getting F-35s.
Yeah. So I think for me, beyond just the obvious bit of the technology, it's what does fifth gen, in this case the F-35, give you? Well, it's not just enhanced capability, really, really important, but it's that capability gives you more choice and it gives you more options. So we don't have to look at a problem in a way we've always looked at it. There's almost a mass element here as well, isn't there? How can we actually package the forces we've got to absolutely exploit the advantages of fifth, and particularly what it does to leverage what we've got in previous generation of aircraft, and indeed, of course, the weapons that other domains are bringing into a fight, because this is not just an air discussion. The sheer number of F-35 nations in NATO, you know, I think we're at now 12, gusting 13, and even that may have been overtaken by events and signatures, puts us in a fundamentally different place. I'm not sure, probably since the days of the F-4, we ever had so many nations operating a single basic type of aircraft. That gives us a ton of opportunity in terms of integration and interoperability. Just look at what it means of developing our tactics, techniques and procedures, our TTPs. And also the headache that you pose your opponent or adversary, who now has to kind of spread bet, not just his thinking, but his or her forces as well, to kind of match what it is potentially that you can bring into any fight. So really important to us, getting the most out of it, really important. The F-35 user group is a remarkably vibrant group within Europe. And as I said, week two of our WEPTAC was fundamentally about understanding fifth gen options against one of our most challenging mission sets. And what we'll get to do, I mentioned Ramstein flag in 24, there'll be a follow-on Ramstein flag in 25, where again we will be bringing in this fifth and fourth gen integration. Again, if I'm being blunt, I worry a little bit at times that it's one of those lazy shorthands, but you think if you just say it, it will magically happen. I think anybody who's been around the blocks a bit on this knows that actually to really exploit both, you've got to go out and test, experiment, and prove that your TTPs are valid, and then don't sit back on your hands, because the threat will continue to evolve against you. So I think it brings us a huge amount, but don't forget that actually what it does is not just give you those choices, it harnesses a lot of the forces we've also got. So the synergies are profound.
If I can, you mentioned the challenges of tying forth the fifth generation integration. And clearly through these exercises, I think you've very well articulated the value that accrues from identifying the challenges. But what else are you doing when it comes to interconnectivity and solving some of those challenges?
Yeah, so that is kind of the world beyond just fifth gen, isn't it? So we have, under that agile combat employment line of effort, which I had sort of set out at the start, it's a bunch of things. It's not just some of the sort of classic things which folk of a certain age will remember, sort of Harriers in field sites in RAF Germany and dispersed jets around road strips in various parts of Europe. A lot of it is actually making sure that the digital structures you've got allow you to bring the different forces together. If I'm being really blunt, it's an area actually where we know we need to be better than we are at the moment. But equally, there is a ton of technology now that we can get off the shelf and apply to this problem. Equally, one size doesn't fit all here. So what are the things which you have to be able to do that underpin that integration and interoperability? One of the things NATO was really good at and then kind of fell away with, back to that long shadow of 30 years, was STANAGs, standardization agreements that allowed you to go and put your, you know, smoking my pipe here for a moment, to put your Jaguar into a base in Denmark where Danish technicians would turn the jet for you and you'd then sign them off as being competent at aircraft cross-servicing. All understood, all documented. We're reinvigorating that. There's a lot of STANAGs still there, so let's go back and test them and update them where necessary. Let's make sure that our digital STANAGs are also fit. And equally, let's get back into aircraft cross-servicing. So we have just about every NATO Air Force signed up for this now. And we're actually going, I think, quite nicely through the gears of getting nations signed off to go and service other people's jets, as we did before. So there's a little bit of back to the future here.
Very good. Let's switch gears for a second and talk about the MQ-9 and other remotely piloted aircraft that are providing highly valued sensor effector capabilities. Could you talk to us a bit about how you view the value of remotely piloted aircraft and what they're delivering for NATO today?
Yeah, so it's a really good question, because this is one of the areas where NATO has some of its own assets. Unusual, because nearly all of the NATO components are relying on what nations bring in. It's a sort of fundamental to how the alliance works. But actually, in this area, NATO does have a fleet of five RQ-4s that it flies out of Sigonella. And we also draw, of course, on a lot of what nations can offer in, whether that is most obviously MQ-9, as you mentioned. But again, there's a host of other drones and RPAs that are out there that we can use. The great thing, of course, is what it gives you against a spectrum of collect, from sort of classic EO IR, that became very de rigueur in the counterinsurgency years, through to, really importantly, synthetic aperture radar and GMTI that again can see through the weather throws, can tell us a bunch of things that sort of classic imagery perhaps cannot, and all points pretty much in between. So in terms of the contribution that those platforms make to our 24/7 intel collection and analysis, that they're one of the fundamental pillars. Coning in on the NATO RQ-4s, one of the things I would highlight recently is missions that we're now flying up to the high north with the RQ-4s, so well up into northern Finland and back again. And of course, that's giving us great reach and some great insights into the battle space. If I had one area where NATO, the non-US part of NATO, I think if we did targeted investment, that would be great, is in offering us penetrating ISR. So one of the things, of course, about a number of drones is they're survivable if the ground stroke air threat allows them to be allows them to operate, and in a contested environment, that perhaps, of course, is not the given that that it has been. So the ability to get platforms that can go in at range and survive is going to be important to us.
Those are obviously going to be larger platforms, small UAVs, not necessarily remotely piloted. We're getting more and more closer to autonomous operations. I've gathered a lot of headlines in Ukraine, and they're having a big impact. On the other hand, they lack the range, the payload, and other attributes required of campaigns in a different theater, perhaps. China fights can pose some very different conditions. Are you looking at these different challenges, and how so?
Yeah. So. Again, I mean, it's probably one of the top three questions I would have thought was, as we look at Ukraine, and you know, a number of commentators, not unreasonably, have kind of gone, you know, this is drone warfare at scale. It's a knee in the curve. It's a bunch of other things. It is a little bit tempting to see that the future is only drones, and you highlighted rightly the fact that, hey, yeah, they can be great, but at one end of the scale, you know, an FPV that costs a few hundred dollars that you can put a weapon on, and you can buy lots of them, and you can afford to lose lots of them, and they still get to the target, you're on the right part of the cost curve if you're doing this, and it gives freedom and choices to other components to do. I think there's a, you know, not a follow-on question, but there's something here, and I kind of touched on it earlier, that I think the nature of how air is integrated within the close battle, you know, that is most definitely changing. And to be fair, Ukraine has only emphasized and perhaps accelerated some trend lines here that we could see already. But they're most definitely not the only show in town. You still need the platforms and the weapons that can reach out and touch at significant distances with the precision and the survivability that you need. And you're not going to do IAMD with solely with drones. So getting the force mix right is going to be really, really important. And back to, you know, what my boss would say on cost curve is really important as well. And so one of the things beyond just that sort of close fight is how do you cleverly and intelligently use effectively what one could call the elements of a high-low mix to really buy yourself options, choice, affordability, and scale that perhaps you wouldn't have done before. So there's so much in that question. I've really only just bounced off the wave tops.
No, thanks very much. That was good. I'm switching gears just a little bit for our listeners who are unaware. Allied Air Command's responsible for managing NATO's ballistic missile defense system. Could you explain a little bit in political terms just how this system works?
Okay. yes, but I'll probably stray a little away from the politics of things and maybe talk a little bit more about the nuts and bolts. So the long and short is, and you know, back to my point on the synergies and really the continuum of IAMD and ballistic missile defense, What you clearly need is sensors that give you long-range warning. So that's one part of the system. You then need to be able to make choice on whether it's a threat to NATO nations or not. So your second part now is really good command and control, but allows you to operate, by the way, at sort of tens of seconds, not tens of minutes, so that you're really deriving what's happening as quickly as possible. And I should have mentioned on sensors, please don't just think ground-based radars. There is a huge space contribution to the ballistic missile defense mission as well. And then, of course, if you need to, you need to have things that can shoot them down. So there are two components here. There's the Aegis system afloat with a number of Arleigh Burke class shooters, and you have one very shortly to be two Aegis Ashore elements in Romania and soon to be accredited Poland that collectively, and again, it's all back to how you posture them, give you the coverage over the European AO. What I would also say, of course, is that puts quite a heady responsibility on the team who are running this. So it's a 24/7 mission throughout the year, and we routinely practice against a number of circumstances, alternate means of prosecuting the mission, etc. So we know we're pretty robust on it.
Now, Russia's been conducting GPS jamming out of Kaliningrad for quite a while now. How's NATO's Air Command addressing this issue in terms of day-to-day training, air policing, and other contingencies that might be tied to an open conflict?
Yeah. We were chatting earlier about how particularly 20 years of counterinsurgency kind of meant we didn't have to worry too much about the electromagnetic environment. So your question, Dave, shows how this never went away. It also highlights the fact, I think, that a bunch of space-based capabilities, you mentioned GPS, but clearly there are others, we've kind of assumed as a free good. Not really worried about it, it was always on tap. And so things that we're seeing, you know, the example you highlighted, show that that is no longer the case. Of course, we've worried about how you operate in contested and in degraded environments for some time. At one level, it's not new, but I think what we're, you know, very usefully having people's minds concentrated back on is the sheer scale of challenge and threat posed, and therefore it's not reduced to a sort of short, limited tactical problem. It's far more fundamental in sort of operational, in an operational sense. What I would say, and you posed it rightly as a military question, but just look what Russian behavior is doing in the civilian airspace sense, where last time I checked, Ryanair and others were not necessarily running a how to deal with a GPS denied environment as they were flying to multiple airports across Europe. So the Russian behavior here is unbelievably reckless. And I think actually should be called out for what it is and the impact, frankly, that it's having on safety of flight. They have a bar set in a different place than we do. I suggest they reset it.
Very good. I think that's an excellent point that most people don't even think about over here. Now, during the Cold War, NATO relied a lot on pre-positioned equipment throughout Europe as part of its deterrence strategy. Where do we stand on that now? And we hear a lot about agile combat employment and distributed logistics in the Pacific. What about Europe?
So, let me go on that agile combat employment on the ACE line. So what you're seeing from a number of air forces is different approaches to addressing the same problem. But here, different is good, not bad. Because by dint of how they're structured, platforms they're operating, everything down to how you recruit and the kind of military and strategic culture in your organization or your countries going to drive things differently. We've put a load of work into ACE over the last sort of 18 months or so. We've just released the first iteration of NATO's ACE CONOPS. And one of the key bits is no matter what nation you're from and what you're operating, what is it that is applicable to all? So part of that, of course, is how you disperse, what your options are there. Part of it, to the opening part of your question, is how do you do the log support? How much do you need to pre-position forward? How much can you safely pre-position forward? And I don't mean that from a sense of safety against attack, but safety against, frankly, the nature of warfare and how fights evolve. So you've got to keep some agility there. You've got to keep some capacity to employ that may limit what in an ideal world you'd put forward, but is probably an appropriate hedge against uncertainties in any fight. Also, you don't have to have any aircraft to be an ace player, because if you've got airfield or you've got logistics support or you've got force protection or you've got a bunch of other things that will enable the overall NATO air power contribution, that is a powerful thing to bring. So really good work here. We are testing some of it at a low level on smaller deployments and exercises, largely so far national ones, but where they're taking that CONOPS and running with it, and we're going to see more of that playing out over the coming months and years.
Well, very good. Here's a, before we shift to our audience, one more for you. The war in Ukraine has been a wake-up call to many NATO nations with respect to the reality of air-based attacks. How's NATO's Air Command looking at managing this challenge? And, you know, are the European nation NATO armies as reticent to put the resources into air-based defense as is the U.S. Army?
Won't speak for the U.S. I'll try and give you a broader sense.
I just thought I'd throw that out.
No. So. A little amuse-bouche at the end. For me, I think everybody realizes, and I touched a little bit on this earlier, that we had a 30-year holiday, really, from worrying about protecting our bases in a way that was an absolute commonplace during the Cold War. Any folk who are on this who've operated modern, fighter aircraft will know that it even permeated the way we designed our support systems and structures. They were very comfortably about main operating bases. We saw the opportunities to contract out to industry, reducing the uniformed headcount, etc. And of course, that limits your choices if you're not careful, if you need to ramp up, and you're in a change context. So, some of the things we're doing, I think, frankly, were the things which a lot of people would recognise from 30 plus years ago. Some of them are really straightforward in terms of dispersal. Some of them are the things that you would want to do because of the speed at which your enemy's targeting cycle works. But you can't just expect that you can deploy everything out, hide under the nearest tree and it will be okay. So at A level, we are going to have to be defending patches of concrete. We're rethinking through what that looks like. You also have to aim off in that sense for the fact that you're never going to be 100% successful. So how do you, within that, ensure? And it's a question, really, I think, of imagination here, not just spend. How do you use everything that you possibly can to pose a challenge to your opponent in this regard? And, I use the Fastjet example, by dint of background, but I'm also guilty of falling into a trap here, which is it's very easy to have a mental picture that what we're talking about is dispersing fighters. Actually, we need to be worrying about our big wing aircraft as well, our refueling aircraft, our large ISR platforms. Where do we put them so they can't be predictably located and we can ensure their survival and they're into the fight as well? So sum all of that kind of up, I think you're seeing genuinely a multi-axis approach from this, from how we train people beyond just core skills, how we ensure that logistics is as intelligently done as it can, regaining some force protection capacities and capabilities that perhaps we lost, and also aiming off for that much expanded threat environment and range of threats that I spoke about earlier. This is one area, rather like the question on drones, where the classics of warfare, of new system, counter, are being played out at pace.
Well, very good. Well, thanks very much, Air Marshal, for those insights. Let's kind of open the session up to questions from the audience. And everyone out there, I think, knows the drill by now. If you raise your hand, I'll call on you. And when I do, please unmute your mic, state your name and affiliation, and then we'll head to the questions. Have several here in the chat room. Let's start with one related to space. This one's from Charles Galbraith. Air Marshal, you've stated a few times the importance of space capabilities to missile defense and other activities. How is NATO planning for the need to gain and maintain space superiority?
Yep, thanks, Charles. Not a loaded question, that one. A fascinating and important one. Back to my free good point. We were worried about domain awareness. Boy, we are massively concerned and focused on space domain awareness now. But the sense of worrying about orbital attack, or indeed any of the space segments being engaged, was something we were conscious of, but perhaps we weren't putting too much effort into doing practical stuff to fix. We're definitely in a different place than before on that. So in terms of hardening the various segments, absolutely. Through to, frankly, the more aggressive and offensive part in terms of space control. I mean, like many things in NATO, and quite rightly, this is something which nations will discuss. And some nations will have different views than others. But I think in terms of a general direction of travel that says we now need to be not just far more worried about how we protect and defend in space, but how we do the practical things that ensure our systems are more survivable, our structures, our space structures more survivable, is absolutely there. And in fact, one of the things I would also highlight here, Ramstein is not just the home of Air Command, it's also where we have the NATO Space Operations Centre. And that, as an organisation, again, probably catalysed in part by Ukraine. But my word, what's been developed over the last 2 years or so there is really impressive. And as a sort of, if I can use a phrase, launch pad here, but as a launch pad for a number of future strands, we're actually in a shape we would not have been in even 18 months ago.
Okay, here's one from Matt Tober. Kind of gets to some of what we started off with. And his question is, given the fact that our U.S. Air Force's average fighter age is well over 30 years old now, and we just celebrated the 72nd anniversary of the first flight of the B-52, and the rest of our Air Force is the smallest and the least ready it's ever been, is Europe becoming concerned that the U.S. can actually come to the defense of a NATO country if challenged by Russia, while at the same time we're pivoting to or preparing for conflict against China and now possibly Iran?
So at one level, of course, you look geostrategically, and it's a pretty challenging landscape, isn't it? So, I think absolutely agree with that. I think what Matt's question does drive at, though, is A, the importance of alliances, not, transactional marriages of convenience. It speaks also to, and apologies for a small digression, It speaks to long-termism, and it speaks to staying the course, and it speaks to genuine bipartisanship on the important issues. But right back to the bit on ages of fleets, etc. I kind of look at it that's important, but I kind of look at it in a slightly different way. What can we all collectively bring into the fight, and how collectively good can we possibly be? So, one of the things which we are absolutely focused on as a leadership in AIRCOM is making sure that everybody's air forces can be as good as they can possibly be. There's a reason why we're doing a Ramstein flag, to provide that high-end test and experimentation. But that sits within a much broader evolving picture of what our training and exercises needs to look like, where actually we take some exercises out of the program because they're either no longer fit for the context we're looking at, or we're doing too many of them, or we're not actually taking the time to reflect on what we've learned through experimentation and then find the means to apply it. The basic questions on recapitalizing forces, so they're not that old. I mean, I think the B-52 was made out of girders, so it's probably got quite a few years left in it. Equally, we all know at the pace of evolution within fighter aircraft, but actually your development, however good and spiral it is, you're still going to get to a point where you're outmatched by the threat. So I'm heartened in this place by the sort of fighter fleet recapitalization in Europe. Best, by the way, we have enough tankers to refuel them and enough ISR assets to support as well, so a properly balanced force. And back to alliances, one of the strengths of NATO and Western liberal democracies, for all of our imperfections, is the ability to support each other beyond just our immediate neighbourhood. So that sense of being able to switch, apply mass to where it's needed against that very febrile context I said at the start, that's a real strength for us.
Yeah, I'll just amplify from a US perspective that, I go back and think about Operation Desert Storm, Granby back in 1991, where the United States Air Force had such a panoply of air forces. It was great to have the partnerships, but we had a lot of stuff. Mm. Today, as you, just to amplify on your points, partnerships and allies are absolutely required because we simply don't have the quantities of airplanes that we did back then. We're less than half the size that we were. So that just reiterates what you said about the importance of allies and partnerships, which, speaking of such, how is the addition, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but how's the addition of Finland and Sweden changed the operational planning of NATO? Both are great additions, but they add to the territory that NATO needs to be defended, and they are high north, which is a pretty unique operating environment. This is from Chris Brown.
Yeah. So, no, great question, Chris. So isn't it great that we've got two air forces who are absolutely steeped in operating in those environments, who we can learn from, apply some of the things they do. I was fortunate enough to go flying in the Gripen at the end of February with the Swedes. Actually, I mean, you know, fast jet pilot, so it's great flying in somebody else's fast jet, but that wasn't the point really. It was the means to go and look at how the Swedes operate. Bare base, configured absolutely from the strategic to the tactical against national defense needs. I could bore for ages upon the delights of the Gripen having winches in its pylons, so you don't need a dedicated weapon loader, but that's one for another time. But the point being is these folk bring in real capability and real experience. Absolutely right on the geography changes. With Finnish accession, NATO now has 800 plus miles of additional border. Importantly, and you mentioned the High North in the question, no matter what, the High North is an area of only ever-increasing importance. So actually now having two NATO nations in that neck of the woods, alongside obviously Norway, it gives us a ton of strategic insight and, being blunt about it, it gives us strategic advantage as well, which I think most of us would want. But I think you will see over, the coming decade plus, the focus on the High North is only going to increase. you know, whether it's opening up shipping routes, whether it's just look, by the way, at Russian reinvestment over the last few years in that area, you know, this again is somewhere where we knew was important, but we were either busy doing other stuff or we thought we didn't have to worry about it, and now we most definitely do. So having Finland and Sweden in great, two great air forces, this is wonderful news for NATO.
Here's one from Ken Stubbs. A number of different NATO nations are pursuing a variety of advanced fighter aircraft. How much emphasis should be placed on developing new fighters compared to buying in sufficient quantity the fifth generation aircraft that we have today?
Yeah, I make myself deeply popular with industry here if I go the wrong way on this. No, it's a really valid question. I think I'll make a much broader comment and then I'll come back to it. I think, you know, again, when you've not had to worry about generating the mass, etc., that traditionally we did, that sort of last 30 years or so, you would quite understandably see why many nations would want to do high-end defense projects that develop their technological and industrial basis. It would be weird if that were not the case. The art now, and I'm afraid, Ken, I'm not going to provide you a great answer to this. The art now is how do you recognize that and play it into a change context? Now, on one level, you could go, well, if there are, you know, bigger buys, in my own nation's just announced a, you know, another increase in its defense spending, that may get you somewhere. I think at some point, will there be coalescence in fighter programs? Well, there might be. There might be coalescence in destroyer and frigate programs. There might be coalescence in armed fighting vehicle programs. I think one of the things which I would really strive for is no matter what, make sure that the programs that are there are interoperable, interchangeable almost with each other from the outset, and make sure that the weapons we are buying are applicable and employable across the force. This, by the way, poses some really interesting challenges where proprietary software and a kind of old school way of doing stuff makes weapons integration incredibly expensive. We have to break that paradigm. And there's an interesting point here, and it actually came out as one of our WEPTAC findings, is how you actually may want to train air forces to use weapons that a platform's capable of carrying, their platform is capable of carrying, but is not in their inventory at the moment. I know there's a bunch of other challenges there, which is, yeah, but the industrial base has got to produce the munitions in the first place. But that sense of training people and giving them the experience and the capability to employ more broadly is going to be really important as well.
Very good. Well, we've got time for one more, and it comes from my old friend Punch Moulton. What is AIRCOM learning from the recent large integrated air and missile defense event in the Middle East 10 days ago?
So on one level, it's tempting to say lots and then stop it there.
Stop.
Yes. Hello, Punch. I think one of the things, and I know I wouldn't actually say as NATO learning, because one of the things we've been pretty vocal at saying, certainly as AIRCOM, is recognizing the reality of threat evolution. I sort of set bits of it out earlier. The fact that you have to see IMD to BMD as a continuum. The fact that at the same time you are rightly worried about taking out ballistic missiles and the rest, you're also now doing drone defense towards the other end of the scale, plus more traditional in the middle. I think, and you know, I'm only quoting open source stuff here, I think the scale of the Iranian attack caught people out. Some of us were saying, no, that's entirely the sort of thing we could expect to see. So scale, the need to be able to do simultaneously defense at every point on that spectrum I spoke about. What that means for how you posture your forces, what that means for the challenges of C2 architectures. Because as I said earlier, you can set up a sort of BMD approach and you can set up an IAMD approach. You need to make sure you can merge the two of those. And then the last point I'd mention, which may sound a bit indirect, but sitting there, being reactive, waiting to be shot at, and then taking down the things that are coming at you, is an approach, but I'd suggest ultimately not a very tenable one. So one of the things you need to do is make sure that your good defense has enough of a good offense in it as well, so that we're taking out systems left at launch, so that we're interdicting the supply routes that take stuff to the front, let alone the means by which such attacks are planned and executed. So it's an array of things. It's not just hoping you've got an invulnerable IAMD shield. And that's one of the things I think which, you know, more broadly, but certainly, you know, the events of the last couple of weeks have once again shown us.
Well, if I may say so myself, I think that you concluded with perhaps one of the most important points of this whole discussion, and that is the most effective way to deal with defense is with a strong offense and taking out the threats before they even get airborne. So, unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of this Aerospace Nation. Air Marshal Stringer, thanks again for taking the time to be here.
Thank you, David.
And from everyone at the Mitchell Institute, we wish you have a great air and space power kind of day.